From Boise State Radio, welcome to New Horizons in Education with Boise State University President, Dr. Bob Kustra.
Support for this public radio podcast comes from Walden University, offering specialized online master's degrees in education designed to benefit teachers and students. WaldenU.edu.
Today on New Horizons in Education, former UN Weapons Inspector Hans Blix.
After the end of the Cold War, the U.S. military became the only military superpower in the world. And I think that that also gave a sort of inclination to make use of the military and threat to have their way. We are actually now, as Kofi Annan has said, sleepwalking into rearmament. The cost of the military in the world is about $1.3 trillion. Military means in the case of Korea would be disastrous. Similarly, in the case of Iran, military means have very strong limitations. You need to have talks and you need to have leverage and you need to have carrots on the table as well.
I'm Bob Kustra, president of Boise State University. Welcome to New Horizons in Education. Hans Blix has had a long and illustrious career as a Swedish diplomat and as an international civil servant, working in the fields of weapons verification and nuclear technologies. Dr. Blix was a member of Sweden's delegation to the United Nations from 1961 to 1981. He then served for 16 years as Director General of the International Atomic Energy Agency. Dr. Blix left the agency in 1997 with plans to retire. But in 2000, he was approached by UN Secretary General Kofi Annan about serving as the executive director of the newly formed UN Monitoring, Verification, and Inspection Commission for Iraq. As the chief UN weapons inspector in Iraq, Dr. Blix led efforts to uncover stockpiles of weapons of mass destruction in the months leading up to the U.S.-led invasion in March 2003. Ultimately, no stockpiles of weapons of mass destruction were found. Dr. Blix's book, Disarming Iraq, published by Pantheon Books in 2004, provides a first-hand account of his experiences during the build-up to the Iraqi war. The Washington Post described Disarming Iraq as remarkably temperate and fair-minded. In late 2003, Dr. Blix was named chairman of the International Weapons of Mass Destruction Commission. Last June, the commission released a final report that contains 60 concrete proposals on how the world could be freed of nuclear, biological, and chemical weapons. Earlier this week, he delivered a lecture looking ahead, controlling weapons of mass destruction as part of the university's Distinguished Lecture Series. He joins us in the Boise State Radio Studios. Dr. Blix, welcome to New Horizons in Education.
Thank you very much. Great pleasure.
And we're just delighted that you've had a chance to spend some time in Boise and get a good look at a part of the American West. But let's start, if we may, with the job of a weapons inspector. I'm fascinated by the task. I guess the first question would be, what kind of educational and professional experience do you bring to the job of a weapons inspector? Now, of course, I just identified the fact that you were for 20 years the Director General of the International Atomic Energy Agency. So tell us a little bit about how you developed your expertise. You studied at Columbia University in law, as I remember it.
Yes, I started my career in Uppsala, Sweden, which is my hometown, and got a law degree there. And then I went to Cambridge in England. And took 2 years to go to Columbia as well, doing research and also being a research assistant of Professor Philip Jessup there. Mm-hmm. So I'm a lawyer. I'm not a chemist and I'm not a biologist, but a lawyer. And I could not be a competent inspector myself. But I, as Director General of the International Atomic Energy Agency in Vienna, I was responsible politically and administratively for a big department of some 500-600 people who travel around the world and go to peaceful nuclear installations and inspect them and ensure that there is no diversion of either highly enriched uranium or plutonium for war purposes. And then I came to the UN in 2002 for the inspections, and before that, preparing for the inspections already to year 2000. Then my job was to train people to get the inspections going and be the liaison to the Security Council. They were the ones who ordered the inspections, so I was the one answering to the Security Council, but I don't do the inspections myself. Mm-hmm. For that you need to have special training. You need to be a biologist or a chemist or have special knowledge about nuclear or about missiles. And we had lots of these people.
Mm-hmm. So help us with what it looked like when you hit the ground, so to speak, in Iraq and began your inspection. What size of team did you have with you?
We had about 80 inspectors who were stationed in Baghdad. And they were then in the different disciplines of chemical, biological, and missiles. And then the IAEA in Vienna had their inspectors, also located, stationed in Baghdad. And we sent teams. They were usually about a dozen people with one team leader. And they could be either for a particular discipline, looking for chemical weapons, or they could be cross-disciplinary and go into places where we didn't know what we might find. And you would want to have experts of several. Now, they always had Iraqi escorts going with them into the country, but we never told the escorts where we were going. So that was the greatest secret. They should not be forewarned that inspectors are coming until they practically see them. And sometimes then you could see that they set out from Baghdad, and the Iraqis would say that they are now going eastward or westward, but then maybe the inspectors would take another turn around the city and go out, so the Iraqis would not know. And in fact, we have no sign that the Iraqis ever knew in advance where we were going. Mm-hmm. And the messages, the orders, the instructions from New York where they would go, we did not send them by secret fax or anything. Mm-hmm. They were hand-carried by people, mm-hmm. so it was very well kept in the mm-hmm. secret.
So how did you know where you were going? That is to say, who gave you the good advice on where you needed to be in order to look for these weapons?
Well, first of all, there had been inspections, as you remember, in Iraq during the whole of the 90s. And for much of that period, I was responsible for the nuclear inspections up to 97 when I left and my colleague Mohammed El-Baradei took over the IAEA as Director General. And then from 2000, I was responsible in New York. Now, during the 90s then, we learned a lot about Iraq. The IAEA learned, and UNSCOM, that was the preceding inspection organization in New York, they learned a lot about it. They had been to many, many places, to ministries and to military establishment and to the secret police and everywhere. So they had been to a lot of places. They had been to factories for chemistry. They had been to biological labs where they make vaccines and so forth, and missile factories. So a lot was known, and our archives in New York were enormous. But then we also followed the news, and of course satellites gave a lot of information as well. And a third source were the governments. Now we turned to government and said, you have your sources, you have defectors, you have spies, you listen to telephone calls, etc., and tell us where you think we should go. The U.S. side wouldn't give us anything until we actually came in. I guess they felt it was useless to give these guys anything before they are there. Other countries did. And as we went in November of 2002, the United States CIA also gave us sites. And this is an important feature because we did have time to go to about three dozen sites given by intelligence. And in none of these cases did we find anything. We reported that to them and to the Security Council. And they should have understood that their sources were poor when we reported there was nothing. In some cases, we found some conventional weapons. In other cases, we found some documents, but no weapons in such destruction because there weren't any. And I think this is perhaps the most gravest criticism you can raise, is that they did not hoist a signal of warning that, look here, our sources may be bad.
Mm-hmm. Now, as far as the inspection process itself is concerned, what's the difference between the quality of the information you get, let's say, from agents on the ground compared to the quality of the information or intelligence you might get from satellite surveillance?
Well, I can give you an example. I think it was in the autumn of 2002 mm-hmm. that President Bush was referring to a big installation that had been used in the early 90s for nuclear purposes, for nuclear development, nuclear items. Not bombs, but for production. And he noted that this had been expanded. And this they had seen through satellites. So he added, what more evidence do we need to have? But when the inspectors go there on ground and they go into the buildings, and the Iraqis, if I remember rightly, they also invited journalists, they found the installations were empty. There was nothing in them. So that's a big difference. From the satellite, you can see the roofs. From inside, you can see what they're doing in mm-hmm. it. There also, the inspectors do not, of course, they don't listen to telephone calls and emails and so forth, but they can ask questions. They can ask the Iraqis, what is this for? What have you used it for? They can see the documents. They can ask for figure, for numbers. When did you start? When did you end? And they take samples. There is an interesting technique is what's called environmental sampling. And this is developed in Iraq, actually, during the 90s. And, you know, the inspectors just take a piece of cloth and they make it over a table and take the dust and the fragments and the particles and put them in a plastic bag and send them home to a laboratory for analysis. And if there's anything nuclear, well, it leaves very great fingerprints. And the same thing is true, a little less extent, with the biological and chemical. So environmental sampling is very, very important. That was actually how the U.S. discovered already in 1990-91 that the Iraqis were dealing with enrichment, because there were American hostages taken in 1990, and they were in Tulaita, which was the Iraqi research establishment for nuclear. When the hostages were released, their clothes were taken by the CIA and analyzed, and they found particles, and they said, well, we can see that they are working on enrichment. So it's a very sensitive and new method.
I want to get back to this inspection process for a moment, but you just reminded me, I believe in your book, you do say that early on in the, maybe it was the early 90s, whenever, you were asked specifically about what the Iraqis might be doing with this nuclear material. And at that time, you didn't rule out emphatically, but you suggested that it was likely that it was for the purpose of a nuclear warhead.
Yes, that was in the 1991 in the Security Council, when before the and after the, probably after the first inspections, when we had found that they were dealing with enrichment, and they had admitted that. And I was asked in the Security Council by an ambassador what was the conclusion I drew, and I said that they don't have any power reactors, so why would they need enriched uranium otherwise? They could get the fuel for the research reactor they could get from abroad without any difficulty. So therefore, you could not see any rationale. It's a little different from the Iranian today. I mean, the Iranians can say that we need enriched uranium as a fuel for the two power plants that we have. Might get into that discussion too, but, but nevertheless, they would have some plausible point for making it. But in Iraq, you could not see that you had any such reason but a weapon.
Well, the big question, what do you think happened to the materials that everyone thought were there and magically were not proven to be there by the inspection team?
Well, we know for pretty certain that they destroyed practically all of it in 1991 before the inspectors got in. There were quantities of chemical weapons remaining which were declared by the Iraqis to UNSCOM and which were destroyed under UNSCOM's supervision later. There were also infrastructure of the nuclear, for the nuclear, which they had not declared and eventually had to be declared, and they were destroyed. There were small quantities of enriched uranium at low levels. They were declared, and they were shipped out of Iraq by us. But the major part of chemical and biological weapons, all biological weapons, were destroyed in 1991 already. So you might say that Iraq was a case of an disarming without really knowing it. He took the order, and his son-in-law, Kamal, who defected to Jordan, he told inspectors from the IAEA and from UNSCOM that this order had gone out and that it had been effected. Now, I think that was a terrible mistake on their part to do so, because it meant that the inspectors were not present at the destruction, and therefore they did not have witnesses of what they had done, that this was destroyed. And much of this then appeared as unaccounted for. And in the UK and the US, they equated unaccounted for with existing. Mm-hmm. Where is it? Mm-hmm. Rather than say, does it exist? So it was a great mistake. But the result was that Saddam and the Iraqi government were able to say to the public, that to the UN, the United Nations, that we have no weapons of mass destruction any longer, and you should lift the sanctions. Now, on the other hand, to Iran and other neighbors and to his own citizens, he could say, look, I'm still dangerous. I might be lying to the UN, and I may still have these weapons, so you better watch out. It is what I've sometimes termed the beware of dog theory. That's to say, you can hang a sign on your door saying, beware of dog, but you don't necessarily need to have a dog for doing that.
That's right.
So that, I think, is the explanation.
Well, if Saddam's goal was to lift the sanctions, then why wouldn't he have enough common sense to know, as you've just stated, that you're going to have somebody watching to make sure those weapons are actually being destroyed? Or who is going to believe him, a man like Saddam? Did he really think he was going to be believed anyway?
Yeah, probably. His ambition certainly was both to get rid of the sanctions and to get rid of the inspectors. And the sanctions were eroding through the 90s. They were very, very severe, you know. I mean, the sanctions were that states were not allowed to buy oil. So they got no foreign currency. They couldn't buy foodstuff. They couldn't buy medicines. And Iraq, which had been a prosperous country, deteriorated. And they'd got terrible children's diarrhea, and standard of living really went down terribly. So the public in the world and in the UN felt, this is horrible, you can't really stand for that. This is, we're inflicting damage on the people, but not on Saddam, not on his soldiers, not on the Secret Service, etc. So the UN then said, we have to allow him to sell so much oil that he can import some food and some medicine. And this was the Oil for Food program. Now, Saddam said, no, I don't want, you lift the sanctions, he said. But the UN said, no, you go along. And he said, okay, eventually, said to Boutros Ghali, I'll go along with it. However, you must allow me to select who do I sell my oil to and from whom do I buy the food. And in that agreement, on conceding that to him, they also gave him the chance for the corruption, for the defrauding of the UN that occurred. Because he could go to an oil company and say, you can buy our oil, but 10% to me. Or he went to the Australian wheat company and said, you can sell wheat to us, but 10% of it goes to me. So this was the background of the Oil for Food program.
What is your assessment of the recent announcement that the U.S. will participate in a series of international meetings that will have Syria and Damascus at the table?
I think it is positive. This was recommended by the Baker and Hamilton Commission, and I think it is wise. You know, sometimes if you feel that the other guy you are dealing with is terribly eager to talk to you, maybe you can exact a price for that and say, okay, I won't sit down with you unless you do this and that. And that's what the U.S. is doing to Iran at the moment. But if your leverage is not so great, if they're not so keen to talk, then it's better to sit down and talk directly. It doesn't mean that you love them. Diplomatic relations doesn't mean that you love anybody, simply that you can talk to each other. And there is a risks, of course, of outside interference. And so I think they have things to talk about. They have common interest, and they should do it. I think they should also do that in the case of Iran, without any preconditions that the Iranians should first suspend their enrichment program.
Well, obviously, everyone is focused on Iraq's neighbors. They obviously play a key role in providing stability for the region. Let's talk for a moment about Iran. First of all, how far are they from developing a nuclear bomb?
Well, they have mastered the technique of enrichment of uranium by centrifuges, and they got and bought this technique of centrifuges from the Pakistani head of the program. The old type of centrifuge that Urenco used once, and maybe they also learned the newer type of Urenco centrifuges. And they have, in the past year, they have enriched a gram or milligram quantity of uranium to 4%, which is what's needed for fuel in an ordinary reactor. They do not have it on industrial scale yet. They have made many centrifuges, but it's a very difficult technique to do industrially, and most people think that it will take a couple of years before they can do it industrial scale. The point is that if you can enrich to 4%, then you can also enrich to 94%, just running the stuff longer. So they would have the ability to make material for a bomb if they would want to, but they deny that they have that intention. I think today perhaps the question of intention really is not really significant, because everybody knows that they could change their intentions, even if they might not have the intention today. In 2 years' time, they could change their intention. And any industrial scale enrichment will increase the tensions very much in the Middle East. So the commission that I have headed, it was also the view that it would be desirable if we were able to dissuade them from enrichment. The question is, in which manner do you do that?
You're listening to Dr. Hans Blix. As you know, he served as the chief UN weapons inspector in Iraq, and we're talking now about Iran. Let's continue this if we could. What would Iran require to back off and remain a member of the non-nuclear community?
Well, in all cases where countries have gone for nuclear weapons, they have perceived security has been an important part of it. When the Indians did it, it was because of China, and Pakistan, India, Israel, the Arabs, etc. So you must ask yourself, do the Iranians really have strong security reasons for going for bombs? And I don't quite see that they do, actually. And that gives me some optimism that it should be possible to persuade them to stay away. They started the program of enrichment in the 1980s. And at that time, I could well see that they were worried about Saddam Hussein. Today, with 100,000 American soldiers in Iraq and American bases in Pakistan, Afghanistan, etc., they probably, and with talk in Washington that all options are on the table, they probably feel worried as well. But apart from that worry about the U.S., I don't think they really have such a need. Now, it's interesting and important to compare with North Korea, because North Koreans have also felt isolated, alone, and worried about the U.S. in particular. And in the case of North Korea, the United States is offering guarantees of no attacks from the outside and no subversion. They also offered North Koreans that they could have diplomatic relations with the U.S. and Japan if they went along with a nuclear deal. But none of these two important features are present, as far as I know, on the table in, with relations with Iran. So if Iran were to be offered security guarantees against attacks, provided that they do away with enrichment and perhaps diplomatic relations, well, I think these would be important things. They have not been tried yet. Mm-hmm. So that's one reason why I think they should sit down. See, mm-hmm. They have been offered a number of other things, which I think are sensible, and the U.S. have supported them, like support for getting into the World Trade Organization, or buying spare parts from the Boeing, or facilitating investment, etc. But these 2 points, guarantees of security and relations with the outside world, I think would be very important.
Has Libya's Gaddafi's decision to not pursue weapons of mass destruction, has that perhaps led the way for countries like Iran who are looking to see what benefits come from a decision like that?
Yeah, they certainly see. I mean, that Libya did benefit from it. Libya had sanctions on after the Lockerbie affair, but also more generally. And so they are getting out of that. But still, there are many differences in it. I don't see that Libya, he was not really a case where he was threatened by the outside. He was attacked right. by the U.S., but what he would need nuclear weapon for is more doubtful. Gaddafi is a different type also from what Kim Jong-il and from what the Iranians are.
Now, one of your major concerns is global disarmament, and I believe you've been quoted as saying that there are still some 27,000 real nuclear weapons in the United States, Russia, and other states. So, and they are on hair trigger alert, and while we're all concentrated on Iran in the future, in the meantime, are we missing something here by not focusing on an even larger problem? Could you comment on that, please?
Yes. I think that it's welcome that the number of nuclear warheads have gone down from 55,000 during the peak at the Cold War and to 27,000 now, though most people will say that this is a redundancy. And the sad thing is that after the end of the Cold War and the beginning of the 90s, we all expected that the world would be very different, and it was very different. President Bush the Elder succeeded in getting his alliance against Iraq and stop the Iraqi aggression. There were many peacekeeping movements that were possible. The veto in the Security Council was not automatic. We got the Comprehensive Test Ban Treaty negotiated and signed, but not ratified by the U.S. We got the Chemical Weapons Convention. So there was a great deal of positive things. But at the same time, something new happened, and that was that the Russian military were no longer relevant as a counterweight to the United States. The U.S. military became the only military superpower in the world. And I think that that also gave a sort of inclination to make use of the military and threat to have their way in directions that they probably thought were good for the world. But you could also see them losing interest in disarmament agreements, in the treaties, in multilateralism. And it started already during Clinton. He ordered the sending of some cruise missiles after the bombings of the American embassies in Nairobi and Dar es Salaam. And one of these missiles landed on a chemical factory outside Khartoum. Had nothing to do with the affair. It was just a destruction, sending a cruise missile on a factory in a foreign country. But more seriously, in 2001, they shot down any idea of having verification of biological weapons convention and the conference about the prolongation of non-proliferation treaty in 2005. The U.S. and the other nuclear weapons states would not go along with any duties on their part to go for nuclear disarmament, as they had promised under the treaty. And the whole apparatus for disarmament stagnated. The conference in Geneva was not able to adopt the work program for some 10 years. And we are actually now, as Kofi Annan has said, we are sleepwalking into rearmament. We have arms races. We have an arms race that has regard to outer space. And recently you had a Chinese shooting down a satellite of their own and thereby creating some 1,000 fragments that are sitting up there in space. And we have the US and the UK planning for new types of nuclear weapons, a new generation of nuclear weapons. So it's paradoxically, while we have detente, where we have end of Cold War, and where there are no conflicts between the great powers on territory or borders or ideology, and yet we have a rearmament, and the cost of the military in the world is about $1.3 trillion. And you in the United States are paying half of that. You, as taxpayers, you are paying half of that, plus the dangers of things that might go off when they are a hair trigger alert. So my commission comes to the conclusion that, no, we have a detente, we have a relaxation, and that should be used to move out of the nuclear era, which was understandable as a matter of deterrent in the Cold War, but no longer. And this is precisely the conclusion that some elder statesmen in the U.S. have come to recently. It was former Secretaries of State Kissinger and Schultz, and former Secretary of Defense Perry, and former Senator Nunn wrote an article early this year in Wall Street Journal in which they argue in favor of nuclear disarmament. So we are no, my commission, we are no odd sort of peaceniks, but I think we are in thinking on the same line as these rather old Cold War warriors.
Right. Well, the commission to which you've just referred, you're referring to the International Weapons of Mass Destruction Commission. Over 60 concrete proposals have been submitted. You said, I believe, in commenting on that, on the work of the commission, that there were some hopeful signs.
Yes, I think there are some hopeful signs now. I think the U.S. attitude of unilateralism and of saying that we don't care for treaties, we don't care for international inspection very much, I think the peak of that has passed. The recent meeting they had on the Biological Weapons Convention was one that was much less confrontational. There will be a meeting this spring about the review conference of the Non-Proliferation Treaty, and I hope that will be also calm. And I think in particular that the U.S. negotiations with North Korea shows that there is a different attitude. There they are, it's in a multilateral context. You have the Chinese, you have the Russians, you have the Japanese and the South Koreans. So you have all the players in the region, and they all have a strong interest in North Korea not continuing on the nuclear weapons line, because if North Korea were to do that, you could very well have a domino effect in that region. But the U.S. is willing to negotiate here. And as I mentioned, the U.S. has been ready to offer guarantees of security and also a normalization of relations, diplomatic relations. And this has now resulted eventually in a tentative agreement, a first step. It has to be a phased affair. And there are many pitfalls and traps in this, but a phased affair. And that is hopeful. And I saw that Mr. Bolton, the former ambassador, U.S. ambassador to the U.N., when he saw about the agreement, he said something to the effect that he hoped it would collapse before the ink was dry. And Mr. Bush and Condoleezza Rice distanced themselves from him and said, no, we disagree with him. So I can see that the fights in Washington probably have been as strong as the fights probably are in Tehran on the Iranian side. And I think that's a hopeful sign. Because military means in the case of Korea would be disastrous. Mm-hmm. North Koreans don't need nuclear weapons. If they are hit from the outside, Seoul is within artillery range. Why was there reason? You can see it. So you can see across the border. It's terrible. And similarly in the case of Iran, the military means have very strong limitations on what you can do. And you need to have talks and you need to have leverage and you need to have carrots on the table as well.
Well, Dr. Blix, we've run out of time today, but I sure do appreciate your taking some time while you're visiting Boise State to join us here on New Horizons in Education. Thank you for being with us today.
Thank you. Great pleasure.
Next week, Boise Economic Development Chief Paul Hiller. Our engineer for today's show is Eric Jones. Research provided by Janelle Brown. I'm Bob Custrow. Please join me next week as we talk to the people who help shape our world in both the Treasure Valley and beyond on New Horizons in Education.